Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. The number is 1-800-638-7781. If you're a first or second time home buyer in Baltimore City, there are many opportunities. They will open for you. 1-800-638-7781, the Maryland Mortgage Program. We are joined here in studio by Brian Griffiths, who is chairman of the Maryland Young Republicans and co-editor of the Red Maryland blog. And Brian, good to see you.
Great to be back.
Brian, how old do you have to be before you can no longer be a Maryland Young Republican?
The second you turn 41.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. The young Dems actually go to it's 18 to 35 to be a young Dem. It's 18 to 40 to be a young Republican. So I fortunately have many years left before I age out.
How you like that?
How you like that, Mark?
I guess I couldn't be either one, could I?
You couldn't, Mark. Well, neither could I.
It's all right. 410-319-8888. Folks, we're going to talk about all manner of things here in the course of this hour. We're going to start, of course, with the South Carolina primary. We want to get your thoughts on that out there, on what this Newt Gingrich surge means, the many other questions to go along with this that we want to talk about with you. So 410-319-8888. One of the things when I watched this primary, and you're not seeing it in the Democrats only because Barack Obama's president and there's a huge body of people across the ideological spectrum inside the Democratic Party and those who voted for him who want to see him win. So you're not seeing the partisanship. Even though some progressives are trying to create that partisanship, you're not seeing it the way you're seeing in the Republican primary. But one of the things, whatever you want to say about Newt, and I don't even know if you love Newt or don't love Newt, about him and personally and politically what he stands for, is what this stands for to me, Brian, is that there is a surge of anger in America. People just do not like where we are. Mm-hmm. And anybody who embodies that at the moment in a given locality is where that where the surge comes from.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's you can see the anger on both sides of the aisle. You see it in the Republican side in the Gingrich surge, and you see it on the coming from the left from the Occupy movement. I mean, it's two very different movements, two very different groups of people, but both have encompassed and have embraced the anger of our times. It's kind of the zeitgeist that we have right now, and they're turning it into. In the case of Occupy, publicity and marches in action, and in the case of Gingrich, they're turning into a formidable presidential campaign that was left for dead several months ago. And it's been very interesting to see. And yeah, Mark, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of palpable anger on the Republican side. And it's not just against the president, the administration, and against Congress. It's against the establishment.
Whatever that means.
In Washington. Right. A lot of the perception is that a lot of the inside the beltway Republicans who are kind of part of the political industrial complex, if you want to call it that, are in the bag for Romney. And that doesn't sit well with a large majority of the conservative Republican voters and the conservative Republican base. And that's where I think a lot of this reaction is coming from.
And I think it's interesting, Mark, about the observation you made, because at any given moment we have watched over the course of the first few months of this Republican contest, Michelle Bachmann in the lead. We've watched Ron Paul be in the lead. We've watched Rick Perry be in the lead. We watched Herman Cain take the lead. All at one time or the other considered front runners, but Romney always considered that top tier candidate. I think that the Republicans are, as Brian said, there's a palpable anger. I also think that there is this internal struggle that we cannot downplay, that they are angry at the establishment. They are angry at the long-serving, long-suffering Republicans who have a vision for an America that Barack Obama is not the president, and they think their best hopes of winning that presidency back. And there's a little slice of racism in there as well. But they think their best hope of winning that White House back is with someone who has a tinge of moderism. Is that a good word? Is that a word?
Moderation.
Moderation. Thank you. And that's what Mitt Romney represents. No matter how much he tries to wrap himself in a conservative cloak, his record speaks to a moderate. And I think that the Republican base, the people who work the hardest in the party, the conservatives in the right wing, in the primaries and in the actual outcome of the election, do not want to see a moderate. They want someone that is completely the alter of Barack Obama.
Well, one of the issues that, of course, has divided the country is, of course, Obamacare. And from the perspective of a lot of Republicans, myself included, it's very hard to beat the guy who gave us Obamacare with its godfather, which is Romney. I mean, Obamacare is basically Romney care on steroids. And a lot of people have problems with that. It's one of the reasons that Romney in national polls until very recently could never crack 25% of support. He could never knock off a lot of the challengers. Anthony, as you said, you know, there has been one series after another, and now Gingrich is again the flavor of the week. And it's making a lot of people questioning whether or not any of these guys are going to wind up the nominee, because you still have four candidates who are running. Ron Paul's running a very unique strategy of he's not even competing in Florida, basically. He's going out to try to pick up delegates in proportional states, which are all the primaries except for Florida and Michigan, I believe, before April 1st. Santorum has won Iowa. Whether or not he can actually turn that into something else is questionable. And it's going to – you know, you're going to have Romney's money both for his super PAC and his own campaign, plus Gingrich, his ability to raise money in his super PAC, slugging it out between now and the convention. There are still people, you know, who think that there's a not infinitesimal chance that we could have a brokered convention in Tampa this year. And it could happen.
Now, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. I mean, there are a lot there to kind of wrestle with this ourselves and where you think America is going, what all this says to us. There are people who look at the Republican primary, who look at the Republican primary. And if you are not a Republican, or especially if you are from communities of color, you go, oh, well, there's a bunch of crazies out there talking to us, so why am I paying attention? But it's about more than Republicans. It's about where America is going. And I think that I was just going to – sidebar here a second. When you said a moment ago, Brian, Obamacare, personally, I understand politically why people use terms like Obamacare. I mean, I find that a little speech. I mean, it was Congress healthcare industry care that came out of there. And it did. And you're right. Mitt Romney's Massachusetts plan was almost carbon copied to put in place.
Including the mandates.
Including the mandates. They were all put in. That, and that is absolutely true. And I'm not a fan of the bill that passed. And I think I'm probably not a fan in a different way than you're not a fan.
I'll bet on that, yeah.
but I think that's real. And I think that Newt Gingrich, though, to me what really shocks me in all this is his playing the anti-establishment role when he is the establishment.
Yeah.
When he is the man who made his $1.8 million working for Freddie Mac as a lobbyist. You know, that where he everything he's done, he's that human being.
That's the funniest part about the four candidates who are left actively running in this race is the fact that the one that the establishment has gotten behind is the one least connected to the establishment. I mean, you look at, you know, Ron Paul has been a congressman on and off since the 70s. Gingrich was elected in 78. Santorum was a two-term U.S. senator. You know, Romney's only got 4 years of experience as – he ran for Senate in 94, but he's got his 4 years of experience as governor. He's never been part of the Washington establishment until the Washington establishment picked him as their guy. So it's a weird race for so many different reasons, and it's been fascinating to watch it play out, and I have no idea what happens next.
Well, I want to ask a question that got John King in a lot of trouble during that presidential debate, but I think it is significant when candidates –
Was he the one who asked the question about the his marital affairs?
His former marriage question. And I won't even get into it that deep, but certainly I think Newt Gingrich took John King and what he called the media elite, the elite establishment media, which he was on every channel of those established media on this past Sunday, making his points. But it was fascinating to me that we cannot force a candidate whose platform involves all of these moral values and American platitudes that he campaigns on, but whose life represents the challenges and flaws that all people, you know, I mean, everyone has some sort of flaw. But I found it fascinating that South Carolinians, especially evangelicals and conservatives, said that his relationship with his former wife and his infidelity played no role at all in their decision. And they made the bulk of the conservatives, 44%, I think, made the decision to go with Gingrich on the Friday, the day before the primary. They were polled. Such a huge number. I find it fascinating that they did not in any way take into account his personal life.
Well, there are a lot of different moving parts in that. One, obviously, you know, as you mentioned, is the fact that Gingrich took John King out to the woodshed and beat him up. And Republicans, that is red meat to the Republican base. just because, you know, we perceive, usually accurately, that we don't get a fair shake in the media.
Unless you own it, like Fox News and all that. Times.
But at the same time, you know, Gingrich has, you know, there's no evidence that we know of that this is continuing to go on. He has, you know, joined the Catholic faith. He has confessed. He has repented. We have no reason to believe that's not sincere at the time. And I think it also says a lot, too, about even Republican voters, because one of the things that has always made me uncomfortable, regardless of my faith, is the fact that we spend too much time in the Republican Party moralizing and not focusing on issues that matter, like jobs, like taxes, like spending, size of government. And if the voters are focusing on those things, that's a good sign for our party, because that means they're focusing on the things that truly matter to the broad base of American people and not just about the fact that – because, look, none of us are perfect.
Of course.
But, I mean, it's if they're focusing on what they think he can do as president, I think that's a good step for the party.
Well, I'm going to open the phones here on the way there to say that I mean, I don't care about people's personal lives when they run for president so much. I mean, as long as they're not – you know, going after little children and doing what happens in somebody's personal life with their wives and husbands is what they do. But for him to have led the onslaught against President Bill Clinton.
Oh, I agree with you.
Monica Lewinsky. While he's carrying on an affair and then asking his wife for an open marriage. I mean, that is that kind of hypocrisy is hard for me, to somebody who wants to lead our country, to recover from, in terms of having the moral, ethical standing to become president of the United States of America. You know, and he attacks Romney about health care when he made, what was it? He made $37 million over 8 years lobbying for the health care companies, partially on this bill.
And not only that, Mark, and I know we got to get to the phones. It is fascinating that hundreds of ethical charges against Gingrich when he was forced out of Congress, hundreds of ethical allegations and charges, and just his record since he's been out of Congress, his lobbying activities. I just think Mitt Romney makes a very good point about the fact that the Republicans cannot afford to send a flawed nominee.
Well, I want to ask some questions. There's a number of questions I'm curious about in this Republican primary that really have nothing to do exactly with what people are arguing about. I have to do other things about what it says about America. After our phone calls here, we'll come back to this one question. I mean, what does it say about America when a huge plurality of Republicans and Democrats will not vote for Romney because he's a Mormon?
Because he's Mormon. Oh, disturbing.
And we'll come back to that. That, to me, what does that say about where we are? 410-319-8888. And Michael, you're on the air.
Mark, can you hear me?
You're on the air.
Okay, fine. First of all, it's not a simple matter as far as what a person does in his private life not have any bearing on whether he's worthy to be president or not. For example, one of the things that would give some people who are inclined to think Republicans are conservative pause would be when you have Governor Perry saying that a person who would cheat on his wife would cheat on his business partner, and in the end endorses the very person he demeaned. And so it would give some people a little bit of a question about whether these are really conservatives or not. And not only that, but as far as the issue of identity politics, which is probably going to have an even greater prominence in this election, whether there should be homosexuality permitted or not in the case of marriage, I'd like to ask, in light of what you talked about a week or so ago, Dr. Martin Luther King, who said that the content of one's character is more important than the color of his skin. And given the fact that even the APA, American Psychological Association, says there's no evidence whatsoever in the DNA for a gene.
Why is it every time you call, the only thing you can talk about, Michael, is homosexuality and people who are gay? I don't understand.
Very simply, because it affects, and you know, thanks, Mark, for not saying that I'm a person who has a reaction formation. You being a social worker are very kind not to give me that charge. But in fact, I'm a family man with five children and a wife, so it's going to stick. But the point is this, that these family values about whether marriage is going to survive or not, or whether it's going to be destroyed because of those who say they're entitled to it, is key in this election.
Well, I think the one thing I probably agree with him on is that I think that marriage will pass the legislature here in Maryland this year, and it will automatically be petitioned to referendum.
It will definitely get up
and
there.
I think when it goes to referendum, it's going to drive those issue voters out, and it may be problematic for the Democrats in this state. Because I think that given – you know what, Mark? The truth is, what I'm dancing around is there are a lot of African-American Democrats who are going to vote against marriage for same-sex couples.
That's exactly what happened in 2008 in California. I think you're absolutely correct that it will be petitioned. That was the DREAM Act petition. That apparatus was actually built in preparation for gay marriage to be petitioned to the ballot. And, I think that, you know, it's – because of the high African-American turnout with the president's reelection up, it's – it will lose if it goes to petition this year.
And a lot of people think that there won't be the distinction that a lot of Democrats, African-American Democrats, will go because the governor supports it. Barack Obama doesn't support same-sex marriage but supports civil unions, that African-Americans will not make that distinction. Well, I have to tell you, in the discussions that I've been having over the last 5-6 weeks with African-American ministers in this city, with African-American Democratic activists in this city, they do not support same-sex marriage. They're going to pull that lever for Barack Obama and probably vote for the DREAM Act. They will not. They will not support same-sex marriage.
And I think the polls all show that particular battle, those battles are very tight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and what you see is such a close in the high 40s on both sides that it is and these are people who I think on either side of those issues are not going to change their opinions. These are people, I mean, you either say, yes, I support the right for gays and lesbians to marry, or I don't. And there's that group in the middle that has to be convinced one way or the other, and that's where the shift is going to take place. And I think that in the question of the DREAM Act, it's the same thing.
And we're probably only talking about probably 7 or 8% either in the middle right there. I mean, you're not talking about a sizable population that needs to be convinced one way or the other.
It's who organizes their vote to come out and who convinces the people that their position is correct in these. Yeah. This is going to be a very – and we'll be covering that with some intensity.
Without question.
That is going to be a factor in what happens. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Rob, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Mark Anthony, for allowing me to make a comment. Personally, for the whole same-sex marriage issue, that's a non-issue for me. I couldn't care less. But my true concern is addressed to basically – a question that you guys had asked earlier from the beginning of your program, which is basically, you know, where is America going from here?
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you right now, without sounding too alarmist, without sounding like some nutcase, I truly believe in my heart of hearts that in the years to come, we're going to devolve into what you would call a corporate state, in which basically you're going to have multinational conglomerates basically consolidating their power to the point where they're going to take on basically the political power of an actual sovereign state. And if you think about it, the groundwork has already been laid with this recent Supreme Court ruling basically allowing for unlimited corporate funding for campaigns. Then you got
Citizens United, right?
I'm sorry, am I done?
No, I said what you're referring to is the Supreme Court case about Citizens United that gave corporations the right to free speech, right to human personal speech, right?
Exactly. And even got Romney talking about how corporations are people. How he championed personhood for corporations.
Right.
So I think in the next 25, 30 years, you're going to see the emergence of corporate states, because a lot of our corporations now, whether we realize it or not, they've got just as much financial power as some of these third world countries. And I'm sure it's only going to increase. That's pretty much all I want to say. And I'll take your comments off the air.
I appreciate what he's saying, because, Mark, what we do know is happening is that as much as the Congress and even the executive branch have worked very hard to bring our campaign contribution laws into some semblance of fairness, what we do see happening is that these corporations have grown extraordinarily influential and actually determining the outcome of not just referendums, but elections across the country by flooding these states with dollars. So, I mean, I don't think he sounds alarmist at all. No. I think that it is a there is real potential that corporations will have continue to have increased influence over the political state. And that's a problem for both Democrats and Republicans, because they're both their establishments are almost beholden at this point to those corporate dollars.
And that actually kind of goes back to the point as to why we shouldn't have campaign finance limits at all, because if the candidates can just go out and raise money and it's all above board, then you don't get these super PACs. You don't get all this other, you know, other stuff of people just trying to hide their money. It's just, you know, it's a lot cleaner that way. And I think there's, you know, there can be concerns about that. But at the same time, you know, you have concerns from the left that corporations are going to take over, concerns from the right that the government's going to take over, and everybody just basically wants to be left alone. So it's a balance to try to make sure that everybody can, you know, be left alone to the best extent practical, and that we all have the opportunity to succeed.
You know, I guess that, and there's something to wrestle with there. I mean, that and listeners, family, what do you think out there? 410-319-8888. Want to know what your thoughts are on this. But see, I think that there's the other side of that. Somebody like, let's say, John Sarbanes, who's not at your political spectrum and a fairly liberal congressman. And what he and some others are trying to do, which is show that campaign finance reform can work by matching funds. In other words, he's saying to people, all right, my donors are giving me X amount of money, but I can't touch that money until I get X amount of money from small donors who will match that money. Then I'll take the money, which is akin to what it would be if you took federal dollars and had these matching funds. But because the other argument is, I mean, people make the argument also that during the McGovern campaign, that if George McGovern had not had unlimited campaign money, people could give much they want from Hollywood and other places, he could never have mounted the campaign he did, win or lose, or McCarthy in 1968. However, on the other hand, people argue corporations should not be allowed to contribute money, period. To not be allowed to have this a Citizens United personhood, that is a huge mistake, that you have to – it personal belongs to us, the individuals. That's how Canada should rerun, and that you have to open up the airwaves for people to be allowed to have their voices heard as they run, and that we have to go back to a much more pure form of democracy. Some people argue that what you're saying, Brian, would just lead to the wealthy being able to run and manage every campaign that exists in America.
But you know what? I'd rather have – if I had to choose between somebody who has to raise money incessantly like we see now and somebody – and a congressman who can go get $1 million check from one company and then can actually focus on doing their job the rest of their time, I mean, there are trade-offs either way. And My default is always to the First Amendment.
But wouldn't you be concerned that then that loyalty or that preference would always be to that corporation that wrote that $1 million check?
It's not that different, and it's not that different from what it is now. I mean, at this point now, you have people beholden to multiple corporations, and actually, you almost have people at this point more beholden to the lobbyist complex, because they're the permanent class in D.C. or Annapolis or Sacramento or wherever you are.
But lobbyists are nothing more than hired guns and mouthpieces for the corporations.
Exactly, but lobbyists also are ones who organize fundraisers for members, who kind of move money around behind the scenes and that sort of thing.
So then the corporations just do it without the lobbyists, or they hire the lobbyists to do it for them without calling them lobbyists.
Hey. Occam's razor.
let me throw this out to you and to our listeners at 410-319-8888. One of the things that struck me about the South Carolina election, 28% of South Carolina is African-American. There's one African-American congressional representative from South Carolina.
Republican.
Right. And there's no that there may be 1%, if that, barely 1%, who of the people who participated in the South Carolina primary were African American, mm-hmm. barely 1%. So what does it say, other than the few conservative African American conservative spokespeople who get out there and have this kind of face of color, that the Republican Party cannot appeal to communities of color at all and don't? What does that say about those primaries and what how that reflects on where America's going? I want to hear what you think about that at 410-319-8888, wherever that position is, and we'll come back here, Anthony McCarthy and Brian Griffiths, and your thoughts on that. Don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
Anthony joins us today, this Monday. I hope that Mondays will pick up again with Anthony in
That'll
the studio.
That'll be nice.
And we are joined here in the studio by Brian Griffiths, who is the chairman of the Maryland Young Republicans and co-editor of the Red Maryland blog. The number is 410-319-8888. Let's take that one thing we just talked about. There's a number of things like this I think are not usually on the radar of a lot of media when we talk about these primaries, but I think that are real issues, that the Republican Party cannot appeal to a majority of communities of color, even in the Latino community, unless you're talking about small part of the Puerto Rican community or the Cuban community, which is a fairly conservative community that opposes Cuban government. There's very little inroad.
So I disagree with saying that we cannot. I will agree that we have not. Because
why do you think that? Why do you think? Why do you think, Brian, that Republicans are have not, cannot, have the have not?
No, I think that we have, you know, part of the problem is that we don't focus enough on outreach into the African-American community or outreach into the Hispanic community. Now, we've done a very good job of outreach in the Hispanic community, Mark, as you said, talking about in Florida, where you have Senator Rubio. We have Governor Susana Martinez, the governor of New Mexico. We have some Hispanic representation in Texas. So we have been able to do a better job of outreach to the Hispanic community than we have necessarily the African-American community. As we mentioned, there are now two members, African-American members of Congress, one from South Carolina, and then Alan West from Florida. I think part of the problem is that we haven't sent the boots on the ground into the African-American community. I mean, it's, you know, part a lot of the time it's election time and you get Republicans who want to try to get voters from the African-American community to vote for our candidates. Well, if you're only there at election time, nobody cares. You know, it's about being in the community. It's about, you know, recognizing the fact that a lot of African-American voters, whether they know it or not, share a lot of the values that our party has, whether it be smaller government or issues of morality or things like that. One of the issues that we have failed to capitalize on has been African-American support for charter schools, particularly in inner cities. And we've seen that in certain areas where there's a high African-American support for charter schools, because you see a lot of folks who live in school districts that are bad school districts in inner cities, and they want to have the opportunity for their kids to succeed. That's an issue that we should be able to capitalize on, given the fact that there's a lot of Democratic, I won't say necessarily hostility, but resistance to charter schools and things that shake up the educational establishment. It's not a matter that I don't think we can, because I think we really can. It's just a matter of we have to have leadership that's willing to actually get their hands dirty and go do it.
And I think to the same argument, Mark, that the Democratic Party really, almost to an election, does a minuscule amount of outreach, because they know that the likelihood, the great likelihood, is that African Americans are going to vote for those Democratic candidates. So we see that in the disbursement of money on these elections. If they're high African American populations, they don't send as many campaign workers into those states and those districts because they assume. And I think one of the greatest perpetrators of this is the Maryland Democratic Party, with a huge African American membership, almost 50-50. Almost, if not, African Americans may make up at least 1% majority.
53% of the Democratic vote is African American in the state of
Maryland. And yet we see time and time again, there are no African Americans that are promoted in any office statewide when these vacancies come apart, other than lieutenant governor. In the party, there have been African American chairpersons, but when it comes to redistricting and other issues, it appears that this party does not look to the interests of African Americans. They look to the interests of protecting Democrats. And part of that's the fault of African American Democrats, who seem to march in lock, stock, and barrel behind this party that does very little to appreciate their loyalty and support.
And that's one of the things that we broke the story on Red Maryland. We were able to do it, is the fact that, you know, the Democrats in their social media presence on Twitter basically came out and endorsed Ben Cardin. And I stood up and asked the question, you know, why, you know, with State Senator Anthony Muse, an African-American state senator, challenging Cardin in the primary, why the Maryland Democratic Party violated its own bylaws, you know, broke its own rules to go out and endorse the white dude who's been in office since 1966. And it doesn't make any sense to me today. Didn't make any sense to me then. And it goes back, Anthony, to the point that you were making, where it's the Democratic establishment in this state takes the African American vote for granted. Maryland is just one of many states in which that's the case.
And so, I'm not sure. And I'm not saying that African Americans don't have a sense of commonality with this party. But I am saying it really speaks volumes at how this party treats African-American members of this party.
Well, before I jump into some questions about that, I mean, there's some other issues I want to raise too in the last 25 minutes or so with this. Let me go to the calls. The callers are calling in here, 410-319-8888. And Jerry, you're on the air. Jerry, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. Great
Hi,
show.
Jerry.
Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on that. Just as a everyday average black man in Baltimore City, because the Democratic primary is the election that you vote in to make sure you get the candidate of your choice, that's why a lot of people are Democrats. But if I had my way, I'd throw both of them away. but the bottom line in terms of Republicans, it's not a question of outreach that the Republicans aren't doing. Their policies look anti-black across the board.
And what do you mean by that?
A social conservative or a fiscal conservative, the policies that are preached by the party are anti-black in a lot of different ways, and the black community sees it as such, whether that's real or imagined. So it's not about outreaching and those sorts of things. It's about policy. A lot of times I have problems, for instance, with crime. Crime is not a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. Crime is a citizen issue, and they polarize people and take these positions. And it just looked like from the Republican Party, when they say tough on crime, they mean tough on black folks. And so when the majority of people see that in the black community, of course they're going to be Democratic. So I just wanted to make that comment. It's not about, you know, outreach. It's about policies. And folks need to, you know, wake up and smell the coffee, because that's what it's all about. Thank you so much, and I'll listen to you off the air. Thank you.
Jerry, thanks so much.
And part of the hurdle that Brian and his party have to jump is that too often the leaders of the party don't have this outreach or goodwill towards the African-American community, unless there is an issue that appears to be exploited for that moment, a partnership between African-Americans and the Republican Party, like around same-sex marriage or like around abortion and those. But they're so – they come across as very insincere. I was just sitting here thinking, Mark, of just the leading candidates for the Republican nomination. Mitt Romney was – talking about the politics of envy when it came to Barack Obama. He practices the politics of envy when it comes to tax policy, when it comes to taxes. Newt Gingrich saying that Barack Obama is the biggest welfare president in our history. Santorum saying he's not giving black people other people's money, and that he, you know, there's language, and even when they don't come out and say, as the caller just said, black, they use this coded language that really feeds to the least characteristics of all people. And that's the Republican leadership. And yet they talk about outreach to the African-American community, which I see as a possibility, but it has to be more than just around election time. It has to be ongoing conversations about those morals and those values that you talk about, those issues of common interest.
So, Brian, let me ask you this question, mm-hmm. So then we'll go back to the phones. And just picking up what Anthony just said, when you hear, and I, you may have a different perspective entirely on what the Republican candidates have said, mm-hmm. and whether or not these statements that people like Newt Gingrich and others have made are racist. I'll be very honest to say I'm one of those who falls in line who think they are, but and subtly racist, some of them, not overt anymore. And if that's not one of the problems that Republicans face, because there is an element of perhaps race and racism in why the vast majority of people who vote for Republicans are white, and the vast majority of and the people who vote Democratic, and I'm not about politics, the Democratic Party being so stellar either, but I'm saying that their vote is really crosses the color line in much deeper ways. And if it doesn't really have something to do with race and feelings about race.
Well, I think a lot of this is inferred, though. I mean, you're talking about the fact that, first off, statistically, demonstrably, there are more people on welfare. There's more people on food stamps under the Obama administration than there were in the previous administration.
But people are unemployed and people have to figure out where they're going to get their food, and that's one of the things they're doing, right?
Exactly.
And they're not people of color.
Exactly. That's the point I was getting to, because so many of those people are not people of color. They are, you know, it crosses the color spectrum. The problem that we have here is that everybody hears a Republican say something and they automatically default to the Republican is clearly a racist. It has nothing to do whether I mean, Rick Santorum or Newt Gingrich running across Iowa talking about the food stamps and trying to get people in Iowa off of food stamps. You know, I've been to Iowa. There's not a large African-American community in Iowa. So, I mean, it's the fact that there's always the default from Democrats, from liberals, from the media establishment, is that anything that the Republican says that even you know, is 1% racism is a clear and demonstrable
Brian,
indictment of racism.
Brian, let me ask you. Rick Santorum campaigning in Iowa, predominantly white audience. The only African-Americans that were there were working for the media establishment. Mm-hmm. They were camera people and working for media. Mm-hmm. Asked a question about entitlements and welfare. Mm-hmm. He says, I am going to stop giving black people other people's money and tell them to get a job. Well, if he's speaking to an audience that is predominantly, if not all white, what could that be other than racism to use blacks as an example of people who are on welfare?
I'm not familiar with him making that statement. So if he did make that statement, that's an entirely different ball of wax. The problem is that when you talk about entitlements cross the color spectrum, we have an entitlement problem in this country. And if we always assume that when somebody talks about entitlements or somebody talks about in food stamps that it's a racial problem, we're never actually going to get to the real problems, which is the fact that, you know, the Republican Party wants to give people – wants to have the rising tide that lifts all boats. We want nobody on food stamps. We want nobody in poverty because we want everybody to be successful. That's why we want to eliminate and reduce entitlement programs, because we want to have a society where people are able – to live freely, and people are able to be successful on their own without a government handout.
So, a couple of headphones, though, we do know that statistically, the vast majority of people who live in poverty in America work. They work two jobs. They work three jobs. They're in poverty. It's not that they're asking for the world to give them handouts. And people add to their income by having food stamps so they can afford to buy food for their families, because of the money they make at the jobs they're making can't make ends meet in terms of rent and food. That's a reality in America.
And if those voters who are on those food stamps have been doing that for a certain period of time, they continue to vote for Democratic candidates, maybe they need to reevaluate who they're voting for.
Though it was neither Republicans nor Democrats have created the jobs in America that pay people decent wages. And the last Republican president we had destroyed the jobs in America that I think the Democrats before him helped start.
Except Barack Obama's job destruction record is blown George Bush's out of the water. I mean, we've seen so many people go out of work, so many people unemployed, and the economy continues to get worse under this president.
Though the employment has gone down. Unemployment has gone down under this president as well.
No, it has not.
8.5%.
More people are out of work under this administration than in any administration in history.
Where did it start, Brian? I'm not here to defend
No, don't look about the unemployment rate. Unemployment rate assumes that people are looking for a job. People have given up under this president.
Not under this president. People have given up in America under George Bush and Barack Obama because this system, as presently constructed, this capitalist system cannot answer the questions of the people of America.
That's because we don't have a capital enough system.
Well, that's not. Well, let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. And let's see. Let us go to Michael. You're on the air.
How you doing, Mark?
Good, Michael. Welcome.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Michael.
What I wanted to say was you pretty much just covered, you know, what I was going to say while I was on hold. But all you got to do is look at the comments that Republicans make in every single election. You know, they're constantly demonizing black people, like, you know, the Santorum and Gingrich Congress about, you know, getting black people off of food stamps when overwhelmingly it's white people on food stamps. I saw a statistic that said it was like 49% white and like 26% black. And, you know, look at Ron Paul's racist newsletter, you know, that he knew absolutely nothing about. You know, he didn't write anything, but it was his newsletter that had his name on the top. And this has been going on since, you know, the beginning of time. I mean, look at Reagan down in, you know, making his speech down in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and the comments he made about, you know, the welfare queens and the healthy bucks on, you know, food stamps and whatnot. And even in 2008, you know, I don't know if you all remember this, but even Mike Huckabee, you know, he played, you know, the race, you know, race baiting game. He made a comment down in South Carolina when there was all this, you know, controversy about the Confederate flag. He said that if anyone ever came to Arkansas and tried to tell us what to do with our flag, he said we would tell him what to do with the flagpole. And then, you know, the whole crowd started hooping and hollering, you know, agreeing with them. So, I mean, this is absolutely nothing new in the Republican Party, and this is why black people don't vote Republican.
Let me get – something that we never answered. I do want to try to answer very quickly. I raised before we went to break. But what it says about us that the vast majority of people in America, many people in America, will not vote Democrat or Republican, will not vote for Mitt Romney, not because of his political viewpoints, not because you agree or disagree with who Mitt Romney is, what he stands for, but because he's a Mormon. That is pretty shocking to me. It's like 1960 and Robert F. Kennedy being a Catholic. I mean, it's like, you know, it's
disturbing.
It's disturbing.
Very disturbing.
But, Mark, I put a lot of the onus on Mitt Romney and the Mormon Church to explain. I think education goes a long way. When Barack Obama was running, he was forced because of his minister to really give that faith speech. What does he believe? Does he believe the things that his pastor was saying, those inflammatory so-called things? And he gave this beautiful speech on what he believes. And I think Mitt Romney has missed opportunity after opportunity to really explain why he's a Mormon and what the Mormon faith is. Because I'll be honest with you, when I went home for Christmas, and I love getting into political debates with people in my family, and I was with cousins and uncles and aunts, they just came right out and said, first of all, they're predisposed to vote for Barack Obama, but they said they wouldn't even consider Mitt Romney. And I said, well, why? Because Mitt Romney's father has a real stellar record when it comes to civil rights, when it comes to his governorship of Michigan. Mm-hmm. But it was fascinating. They said, well, because he's a Mormon. It wasn't that he was a Republican. It wasn't that they didn't. It was because he was Mormon.
There are a lot of people both and Mark, you're absolutely right. I've talked to people inside and outside the party, and they've used the word cult. And it's bizarre to me. This is 2012. You know, this is not, you know, it's not exactly like we're talking, you know, about some fringe religion. Mormonism has been around for a long time.
Yes.
And unfortunately, you know, you made a good point. Mormonism is kind of where the Catholic Church was 50 years ago, where people had all these misconceived notions. And I certainly don't profess to be an expert about Mormonism or, you know, that I, you know, understand a lot of, you know, their belief system. But let's face it, he's been a governor of Massachusetts. He's led a... Yeah, led a reasonably, you know, exemplary life. He's not, you know, he's not being accused of any ethical misdoings, and it's, you know, it's really just weird to me. I mean, it seems to me that if you're predisposed to not vote for Mitt Romney, that's just a convenient excuse, and I don't I don't get it.
Mark, I'm curious what you think, though.
I think it's absurd. I mean, the idea of not voting for somebody because of the color of their skin or how they worship is just madness.
Yeah.
And I don't think that Mormonism is any more or less of a cult than any other religion on the planet Earth. You know, and that you have a left wing candidate running for president named Rocky Armstrong, mm-hmm. who was mayor of Salt Lake City, who's also a Mormon.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
The Justice Party he created or helped create. Let's get back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Let's go to a caller, folks. If you don't get upset, I'm going to go to people I know who have not called in a while. Let's go to Glenda in Baltimore. You're on the air. Hi, Glenda. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Glenda.
Hi, my name is Linda.
Ah, sorry, Linda. Oh.
Okay. My statement or my comment is, it's always very interesting to me that when people talk about things that they haven't heard, the comment that Rick Santorum made in reference
to
not giving any entitlement to African Americans in terms of eliminating welfare while he was talking to a predominantly white audience. That was a comment that was heard across all major networks and on CNN. I don't understand how the gentleman who said he had not heard this, if he is actually a supporter of Santori or anyone in the Republican Party, that he would not have availed himself of this kind of information. These are the things that really cause, I believe, African Americans to have such disdain for the Republican Party.
First off, gentlemen, it's the nicest thing anybody's called me in a while, so I appreciate that.
You're a gentleman.
I also don't watch. I don't watch the network news. I mean, it's at some point, and honestly,
me either.
Yeah. And you know what? At some point, I'll be honest with you. It's gotten to the point in the process where I have so zoned out of what's half of what's going on in this field. You know, I was a Perry supporter. I have not signed up with another candidate yet.
You were a Perry supporter?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I thought he had the best vision of limited government and conservative principles and values to bring to the White House and the best level of executive experience. The three guys that we have left, three main guys, are big government conservatives to me. And Ron Paul, I swear, is from Mars. So, it's I didn't hear it. I'm not gonna pretend to comment on something that I am not familiar with.
Let's go back to the phones. Linda, thanks so much for the call. And let's go to Leslie in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Good evening, man.
Hi, Leslie.
Hey, Leslie.
For the record, man, I'm an independent. The thing that amazed me the most, man, is since black people represent such a large voting bloc in this country, I mean, it should occur to somebody educated that, you know, maybe they could think about establishing their own political party. See, that's the problem right there, because in every instance, neither the Republican Party nor the Democratic Party has ever shown that they're willing to incorporate black people into the pulse of this society. In every instance, you know, when you think about throughout history, black people always came down as being calculated as political fodder. See, and then you hear all of our black scholars and media heads, and they always, every time the political season starts, you get all these people that want to pontificate about this and that with the different parties, when the real issue is neither of them, white people don't like black people in general. It don't matter where they come from. I mean, I think that we should talk about what it would take to establish our own party. See, then black people might have a chance to be recognized.
And Leslie, I'm not rushing the call. We have one more call to call in and try to get another thought here if we can. Unless you want to have a comment, Anthony, or Brian. Leo, you're on the air. We have about 2 minutes left. Let me get you in there for a second.
Good evening, Mark and Anthony and everybody. How you guys?
Good.
Good.
Listen, the majority of eligible voters in the United States don't vote, period, whether they're registered or not. They don't vote because they don't trust this very corrupt system, which focuses on and highlights and promotes institutional racism across the board. November of 2011, the mayoral election here in Baltimore City was classic benign neglect and, in effect, tantamount to suppression of the black vote. There was no effort to get out the vote in Baltimore City in November on the part of the Democrats because they wanted to maintain the status quo. There's no effort to bring into play term limits in the state or the city council because you've got people like Mike Miller, 40 years in the state legislature, you know, and we can go on. Barbara McCulkey, 35 years. Rochelle Ricky Spector, 35 years in the city council. These are all examples of tyranny and staying at
the level. And,
Leo,
we're just about out of time. I've got your voice near the end, and one last thought. Do you think we didn't get into voting rights and states, which I wanted to do, which we'll do next time you're here, Brian, because I want to get into that in terms of how this race could pan out in November and what those things mean, because I think that's very critical of what's going on. Do you think any of these candidates, four left, could take on Barack Obama?
I think that Ron Paul cannot be anywhere closer to the nomination than he already is because I think he would split. A lot of Republicans probably wouldn't vote for him. I think that any of the other three major candidates that we have left could absolutely beat Barack Obama. And I'm still not convinced that the nominee of our party is running for president yet.
I think when people start voting their self-interest and hold their party accountable, whether it's the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, I think that's when you are doing your civic duty. When you allow a party to trample on you, take you for granted, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you are not living up to your full potential and your power at exercising your voice. And I think the Democrats have been neglectful of a party base that they take for granted.
Brian Griffiths, good to have you back on the show again.
Great to be here as always.
Great to have you in the studio. Chairman of the Maryland Young Republicans, co-editor of the Red Maryland blog, and of course my dear friend and colleague, Anthony McCarthy, who is host of the Anthony McCarthy Show every Friday here, 5 to 7 p.m. on WEAA. And thank you both. And Anthony will be back on
Monday, I think. Wednesday.
Wednesday. We talk about the State of the Union address. So thank you all for being with us. Thank you all for calling in and bringing your thoughts to the airwaves. The Mark Sanna Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Cricket Aronson. Our assistant producer, manning the ship all by herself tonight, is Cassandra Monsanto, doing it well as well. May say Jamar Jones is our engineer. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. You heard a lot of Etta James in memory of her who just passed away at 76 years old. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, find out information about our guests, what they're writing and thinking about, please go to our website, steinershow.org, and you can find the information there. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Get ready for some Morgan State University basketball, and take care.
I hope you don't believe what they say. Do nothing till you hear from me. Pay no attention to what's said.